Hallo, this is the netzpolitik.org podcast. I've here John Peribalo from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. My name is Marcus Beckedahl. And John Peribalo wrote the Declaration of Independence 10 years ago and held it in front of the World Economy Forum in Davos. So John Perry, can you give us some impressions how it was to talk in front of all the politicians and economy leaders 10 years before, and what your impressions are now 10 years after?
Well, you know, actually at the time, I was angry about one particular thing, which was the Communications Decency Act, which had been signed into law in the United States the day that I wrote that. And also, I was angry at the people who were at the World Economic Forum for their complete obliviousness to something that these people, who were, you know, actually smart and not bad-hearted, honestly, to what I thought was a very important human development, which was the creation of the internet, you know, and the sudden explosion of it, which was going to, in my view, change everything. And I was thinking a lot about the folly of sovereignty under those circumstances. First, you know, that America could think that it would be able to ban certain words on the internet, you know, that it had the right or the ability. And, the folly of sovereignty that was readily on display all over Davos. So I just sort of ripped this thing off. I just did it quickly. If I had it all to do over again, I mean, I wasn't planning on it becoming a big deal. I sent it out to some friends who sent it out to some other friends, and the next thing I knew, it was everywhere. If I'd realized that it was going to be everywhere, I would have been a little more careful about what I said, and I wouldn't have been quite so arrogant. I might have used a rhetorical style that was not something that I was borrowing from Thomas Jefferson for symbolic reasons. And I would have been more thoughtful about the difference between cyberspace and the physical world, which, you know, in fact, they're intimately connected, obviously. But they're connected in that same way that you know, the mind and the body are connected. I mean, cyberspace is to the physical world as the mind is to the body. They need one another, but they are different. In any event, 10 years later, you know, aside from the fact that if I read this thing out loud, which I did recently in Switzerland, 10 years later, it sounds ridiculous. I mean, just rhetorically ridiculous. And you know, it's embarrassing a little bit, but in terms of the substance, I would say that I've been fundamentally right about some of the things that were said there. I mean, that cyberspace does have an independent existence, politically and culturally, and it continues to, and that it is naturally anti-sovereign and continues to be. And there have been many, many, many other efforts to make it, you know, to make cyberspace divided into various national zones where various national interests can impose their particular will on it. I would say these have been pretty universally unsuccessful. I mean, including China, where everybody thinks, okay, well, the Chinese have actually figured this out. They have not figured it out, nor, in fact, do they really seriously want to. They just want to look like they have. It is still the case that we're creating a social space here where in the future, I think it will genuinely be possible for anybody to say anything that they want, and anybody else who's interested anywhere on the planet will be able to hear it, despite many efforts to stop that from happening. We have to go on being vigilant about this. I mean, if if I were perfectly sure that this would just take care of itself, I wouldn't still be, you know, spending a lot of time and energy on the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Because I know, as many do, that you can actually change the nature of cyberspace fundamentally by changing the architecture of the internet. It's not so much law as it is technical architecture. And there have been various attempts, and there's another major attempt underway now by the entertainment industry, where, you know, Windows and Intel have a, you know, the trusted computing model that would change the architecture of computing in a way that I think would be very dangerous to what I consider to be a fundamental human right, which is the right to know. I mean, nobody ever created a document that grants you the right to know, but I think it's an, as Jefferson would have said, an inalienable human right.
You are one of the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the coolest organization around digital rights in the world. What were the starting problems, and would you have done anything else? Wrong question. Would now be
change it now?
Yeah.
No. I mean, first of all, I mean, when Mitch Kapor and I started EFF, we weren't planning on having an organization at all. We could see that there were some problems. Both of us had had a visit from the FBI, and both of us had found it, I mean, in connection with something called the New Prometheus League, which had taken some of Apple's source code from the ROM chips in the Macintosh and was passing it around. And I had this visit from the FBI where, you know, the guy spent 2 hours explaining to me, I mean, I had to spend 2 hours with this FBI agent explaining to him what the crime was before I could start telling him why I hadn't been the likely person to have committed it, if it was in fact a crime. And so I got disturbed about this because there had been a number of things going on, several different things that I knew about, where there were search and seizure that was overbroad. There was the government was coming in certain cases regarding hacking, where they were, it was obvious that they didn't know that, you know, the First Amendment applied to bits as well as ink. Of course, I didn't realize at that point yet that the First Amendment didn't actually apply to cyberspace, because I hadn't decided to start naming it something, which I did shortly thereafter, just so it would have a political identity. I borrowed a word from my friend Bill Gibson and started calling it, you know, it was a science fiction term from, you know, sometime in the future. I said, well, no, it's already here. I mean, cyberspace is where you are when you're on the phone, but it's especially where you are when you're on the internet. And I could see that there were these things going on, and I wrote something about it, and Mitch Kapor read it and dropped out of the sky one day in his jet plane, literally in Wyoming, and we spent the afternoon thinking about it. And then we thought, well, we'll call up some hot dog civil liberties lawyers, and we'll investigate some of these hacker cases that, like the Legion of Doom in New York and the Steve Jackson Games case and the and FRAC and various things that I happen to know about, and see if we can't, you know, take him to court and get him sorted out. We hadn't been at this very long before we realized that we were, you know, it was not going to be a small thing to sort out. It was going to be a long process, because what we were dealing with was like that point of shift between the industrial period and the information age, and all the powers that had been, we're going to try to go on being powers that were, even though all power was about to get renegotiated as a consequence of this development. And now at this point, this is 1990, there probably weren't 500,000 people with email addresses, but both of us knew this. And we knew that the whole thing was going to expand dramatically, you know, and eventually would be a social space that would include everybody on the planet, which it appears likely to do. And that if we didn't get it right in the beginning, then it wouldn't be right later on. EFF, you know, tried various, you know, after we started an actual organization, I mean, we went about it in a variety of ways that, you know, were sort of traditional organizational models, and we made mistakes, and the EFF damn near died several times. But, you know, now I would say, you know, it is very effective. You know, it's taking on an awful lot of very large corporations and governments and generally winning, in spite of the fact that they have, you know, considerably greater legal horsepower in terms of budget than we do. But it kind of helps to be right. And we're, you know, much more cunning now. And we've got a, you know, a staff that is, like, truly brilliant and dedicated. And I'm proud of having created it in the first place, but I'm much prouder of what others have done, you know, who work for EFF over the years, and what they're doing now. It's not so much what I do, and Mitch is no longer really involved at all, except that he certainly helps out financially. I'm proud of John Gilmore, who came along just shortly after Mitch and I decided we were going to have an organization. And, you know, he's been, I think, the moral compass of EFF all along. Because he's a man of very serious principle. And he's our conscience, I think, a lot of the time. And he's stuck with it, and I've stuck with it, and a lot of other people have stuck with it in a, I think, a pretty practical way. And I'm, you know, I'm glad it exists. And I my only regret is that my hope that there would be like an EFF Germany and EFF Switzerland and EFF Japan has not quite materialized. We didn't want to go out and start, you know, creating international chapters ourselves because we believe in a distributed model. But we hoped that they would be naturally self-generating, and in some cases they have, but not to the extent that we would wish. That's the principal failing, I would say. That and the fact that, you know, because so much of it is identified with John Gilmore and me, who are a couple of old hippies, that it has a certain Birkenstock factor that makes people take it less seriously than they might. You know, Birkenstock isn't sort of a, yeah, right. Oh, that's right. So there's a cultural element that actually may be good, because I mean they don't see us coming, in a way. I mean they think, well, that's a bunch of hippies in California, and then we kick ass.
One of the main topics the EFF is working on, mainly in the last years, is copyright. You've been a songwriter for Grateful Dead in the past, so you have a big view inside the copyright industry, and you've been a big criticizer of the industry, the entertainment industry. What's wrong with copyright?
Well, you know, nothing is necessarily inherently wrong with copyright. It's just that there is something quite wrong with the idea of intellectual property, I mean, which is a very recently developed idea. I mean, if you go back 30 years, you won't hear people talking about this stuff as property. It was meant to be a temporary license for a monopoly on expressing a particular thing, a form of expression. I had this revelation in about 92, where it just dawned on me all of a sudden that if we were going to have an environment where people could speak freely, that the idea of owning speech was going to be fundamentally incompatible. You cannot own free speech. Now, there are other ways to monetize it. There are other ways to regulate the economy there. But the idea of looking at it as though it were kind of property like, you know, any other manufactured item was simply not going to work, because one of the most basic human desires is to share useful information. I mean, it's not quite up there with sex and hunger, but it's almost up there with sex and hunger. And, you know, you are not going to be able to stop people from sharing information on the internet if they thought it was cool. Because now, all of a sudden, you know, anything that human beings can do with their mind can be reproduced infinitely at zero cost and distributed infinitely at zero cost. And I figured that copyright had probably been working mostly because it was hard to actually make a book. It took an industrial process. It was hard to make a CD. It was hard to make a film strip, I mean, and distribute it. All these physical things. But suddenly, you know, information was about to be liquid, not requiring bottles, because we were building this gigantic, you know, pipeline system that made the bottles kind of go away. And I also was thinking that, you know, the economics of this stuff might be fundamentally different from the economics of physical goods, you know, where there's an obvious relationship between scarcity and value. In fact, with information, which is, you know, not embodied in a physical artifact, there's a relationship between familiarity and value. So, for example, if I had like the biggest diamond in the world and nobody knew that I had it, it would still be enormously valuable. If I had the greatest song in the world and nobody knew that I had it, it would be valueless. I mean, I have to share it in order for it to become valuable. So it's quite different. And furthermore, you know, I can, if I have a piece of physical property and you take it from me or I sell it to you, I don't have it anymore. It's as simple as that. If I have a piece of expression and you take it from me or I give it to you or you buy it from me, then I still have it. That's quite profoundly different. But I just had this notion, and it took me a long time to get EFF to come around to the idea that this was important. First of all, I mean, we knew that we would lose most of our funding, which came from traditional organizations that put a lot of value in the idea of intellectual property. I mean, we were getting a lot of funding from Microsoft, from Bill Gates personally. So I wrote a piece in Wired in 93, not as EFF, but just as me. And Bill reacted so strongly that he quit funding EFF as Microsoft. He quit funding it personally. And in fact, he even told his employees that if they funded EFF in any way, that you know, they might be out of a job. So we knew it was going to be trouble. But also, you know, I had a hard time getting my colleagues to see why I thought this was so important. You know, now it's kind of a commonplace and everybody understands this, but at that point it didn't seem that anybody did, with the, you know, the possible exception of Richard Stallman, you know, which was a tricky thing to find myself, you know, one of two people on the planet that thought something, the other one being Richard Stallman. Because I'm a cattle rancher from Wyoming. I'm not like Richard Stallman. But we both had this idea. And now, you know, here we are in Brazil at a Creative Commons, International Creative Commons Conference. And, you know, people from all over the planet get this big time. You know, and any kid anywhere gets this. You know, they know. And these things are all changing, but, you know, they're changing with a struggle. And when you think about the struggles that occurred in the wake of Gutenberg, you know, all the wars and the, you know, the terror and horror, we're actually getting off kind of light here. Things are moving right along. People aren't generally getting killed. And so, you know, it's coming along. And we're developing as a species new ways of understanding the economy of expression, which I had a natural instinct for because I'd written songs for the Grateful Dead, and we'd always given away our stuff in the sense that we let people take our concerts, you know, tape them. And it had never been anything but good for us. I mean, we kind of invented viral marketing without even knowing it. So I knew that, you know, this model was going to work for a lot of people once they got over the idea that if somebody else had it, then it was less valuable. But that takes some time, you know, and it's taking time.
A lot of listeners to this podcast are interested in digital rights issues. What can you tell them how to start becoming an activist?
Well, I think you start becoming an activist in the same way that I did. You see something that you know is wrong, and you start trying to figure out what you could do about it in your own local circumstance. I mean, I didn't have any. I could see that that there were things going on with the, you know, these various cases. I called up the American Civil Liberties Union. They didn't. They said we don't do that. And I realized there wasn't any method of doing that that I could see. So we just kind of had to come up with one, and we did. I mean. And we're still working it out. I mean, our original impulse was to turn to the courts within the United States. But at that point, you know, much of the internet was in the United States. It was a lot easier. We knew that that was not going to be the case for very long. And then it was going to get trickier, which it has. But after we realized that you know, the First Amendment was a local ordinance, then we started turning our attention toward architecture in addition to legal cases. And we've done a lot, you know, to influence standard settings processes and that kind of thing. You know, we just look for the points of leverage. We look for the stuff that is gonna make the internet less open and less free. And then we try to fight that. And we promote the things that we know are going to make it more open, you know. So we do things like the Tor Project, which, you know, is a kind of a wonderful way of helping out anonymity, and if that's what's necessary. And one of the reasons that China is not as closed as you might think is because there are Tor servers all over China. So it's possible to, you know, distribute a lot of digital material anonymously. So, you know, it's that kind of thing. You just have to find the points of leverage in your own local context. And if you care about it enough, you'll find the means, just like we did.
Okay. Thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you, man. It's always good to see you.